and welcome to the June installment of SearchCRM.com's podcast series, Creating Customer Value with Peppers and Rogers. I'm Amanda Malgieri, Assistant Editor. This month's podcast features questions from SearchCRM.com readers that deal with building customer trust. Don Peppers discusses the two main factors that impact the trust a customer has in a company and talks about a few organizations that are making customer trust a priority.
One question we have is, what are the main factors that impact how much trust a customer has in a company? Well, there are two essential ingredients to trust, really. First, a customer has to believe that your intent is to do him no harm or to act in his interest, okay? And second, a customer has to believe that you have the capability and competence to act on that intent. Taking these two ingredients one at a time, Charles Green, who wrote the book The Trusted Advisor, suggests that the more self-oriented a customer suspects that you are, the less he is willing to trust you. That has to do with your intent. If a customer thinks, in other words, that you are conveying a message that's intended simply to accomplish your own goal of selling him something for yourself so you can make a profit, then he won't trust you. He may or may not elect to buy in response to your message, but he will make his own decision because he's judged that your advice is not reliable. It's biased, in other words, toward your own self-interest. This is why companies increase the trust their customers have in them when they advise a customer not to buy something, even when the customer is ready to buy, if the company has information that the customer doesn't really need the product or service. For instance, when you get ready to buy a book or any other product from Amazon that you've already bought once before, Amazon will warn you that you've already bought this and ask if you're sure if you want to buy another. And if you're all set to buy property insurance for a new house from USAA, the direct writing insurance company famous for its customer service, the company may actually talk you down from the amount of insurance you thought you needed if they judge that you don't really need it. Perhaps because $100,000 of that $400,000 house price was really for the land and not the structure, so you don't need to insure that. Clearly, your customer judges your intent by your communications and your actions. And if your intent is simply to sell, 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 whatever you can get him to buy, then you won't be earning his trust. Customers can smell the profit on your breath from a mile away. But the second big ingredient in trust is competence or capability. Even if your intent is wonderfully customer-oriented, do you have the capacity and sheer business skills necessary to act on that intent? It does you no good to declare that customers are the salt of your earth if you don't have the systems necessary to tell a customer the status of his order, or your call center reps don't have the training required to be able to help customers get what they really want. You undermine trust every time you ask a customer for information he already gave you. You undermine it with bad product or service quality, shoddy repairs, poor performance, or inaccurate invoicing. So to earn a customer's trust, you have to, one, want to act in the customer's interest, and two, get the basics right in your business and be able to act in the customer's interest. And these are not either or criteria. They are both and criteria. You have to be able to do both things. Another question. Instead of calling into our call center, many of our customers are going to our website to get answers to their questions. How should we change the way we deal with customers online in order to build customer trust and customer satisfaction? Interacting with masses of customers individually is a complicated and difficult business function. You know, most companies have only begun wrestling with this function in the last decade or so because the World Wide Web has finally forced them to. There are a handful of businesses that have always done a sterling job, even prior to the web's arrival, of using their call centers to inspire confidence and trust in their customers, USAA, for example. But for the vast majority of companies, prior to the rise of the web, call centers were mostly treated as just one more cost of doing business. Customer interaction, in other words, is still a brand new discipline for most business people with lots of unknown complications and unappreciated benefits. I know that many executives charged with supervising the customer experience or trying to structure their company's many interactions with individual customers have trouble articulating the case for earning customer trust. But I still think this is the most important objective you can have when it comes to guiding customer interactions. You know, I just finished reading a new book by Bill Price and David Jaffe, The Best Service is No Service. Jaffe is a customer experience consultant operating out of Australia, and Price is the ex-VP of Global Customer Service for Amazon, which says a lot about their perspectives because Amazon is certainly one of the world's true icons of great customer service today. If you're struggling with the issues of how to improve customer trust when people use your website rather than your call center, then you could do a lot worse than simply buying Price and Jaffe's new book and reading it cover to cover. I did. And then read it again. I did. The truth is, customers don't make a big distinction between the channels they use. They choose the channel for their own convenience, but no matter what channel they employ, they expect to be interacting with you, the company. And it ought to be an interaction that is roughly consistent across all channels. Still, with respect solely to the websites, some of the advice in the Price and Jaffe book is very good, and it's very basic. For instance, at the website, phone numbers should be clearly shown or available on every page, along with talk to someone or chat buttons, and contact us buttons that make it easy to send emails, stating how quickly your emails will be replied to. Website choices should be consistent with other similar lists of choices available from other channels, such as the interactive voice response mechanism, the IVR. Price and Jaffe recommend using plenty of white space on web pages so customers don't feel overwhelmed or lost and can easily navigate where they want. White space costs you nothing, but it delivers better clarity and understanding to the customer. Multiple support levels should be available so that your website is carefully designed to help users recover from mistakes or problems. And standard, straightforward navigation features should allow users to drop breadcrumbs during their web search. Question. As a salesperson, I often deal with customers in person. Can you offer me any tips for building rapport and customer trust in my interactions with potential customers? Well, personal selling is one of the most important aspects of almost any business career because you're always selling, not just to customers, but to your boss, your peers and colleagues, even your friends. Persuading others, pitching your case, whether the people work for you or you work for them, call it what you want, but understanding how to get someone else to do what you want them to do is one of the most basic skills of being human. In terms of dealing directly with customers, my favorite advice would come from Dale Carnegie's classic book, How to Win Friends and Influence Others. Get a copy of that book. You can read all the current how-to books you want, but you won't find better, more concise advice than Carnegie offered. Remember people's names. Ask about their feelings. Try to understand them and their own points of view. These are the building blocks, not just for great salesmanship, but also for lasting friendships and relationships. After you first read Carnegie's classic, then you might want to get a copy of my own book, Life's a Pitch, Then You Buy. You can get it on Amazon, and it'll give you a lot of tips on making that pitch to a customer, whether in a big meeting or a face-to-face encounter. I wrote that book back in 1995 based on my experience doing face-to-face selling as a new business director for a series of advertising agencies, and I think you'll find that it's still a fun read, still has very practical advice. Question. How does the use of outsourced call center agents affect customer trust? Do customers tend to trust an outsourced agent less if the accent differs from their own? You know, it's troubling to me that because so many businesses see only the cost of interacting with their customers and not the benefits, they often resort to outsourcing or automating these interactions in ways that customers find difficult to deal with or even overtly hostile. There's nothing wrong on its face with outsourcing your call center activities, but most companies do so for the wrong reasons and therefore set the wrong objectives. Personally speaking, I don't mind dealing with a call center rep who speaks with an accent, as long as they can solve my problem or get me what I want. It's when the rep can't get the information they need or can't make an exception to the rule even when they know it's justified. These are the things that get my goat big time. But I have the same problem with interactive voice response units. Can't count the number of times I've abandoned a call after being trapped in a maze of unhelpful options with no clear way to talk to a human being. There are some call center outsourcers who really get it, however. For instance, I met the CEO of Contax, C-O-N-T-A-X, a Brazilian-based call center outsourcer with 64,000 employees in Sao Paulo when I was there a few days ago for an event. He told me that Contax contracts with most of its clients to handle their call center calls by charging a flat fee per customer served, that is, for how many customers the client has in their customer base. Rather than charge for the call, he simply imposes a flat contract charge to handle all customers. So obviously, you know, they calculate about how many calls there are per customer per year, and they try to cost things out that way. But his incentive as a contract outsourcer is to reduce the number of calls received by handling them all very well the first time, right? Most call center outsourcing companies charge on a cost-plus basis, charging strictly by how many calls are actually handled, which implicitly assumes that handling customer service calls is a cost rather than an opportunity. And this matches very well with the way many companies think of their call centers. But under this old model, the more calls you have to handle, the more you get to charge your client. Contax, I think, is unique. The CEO said he didn't know of anyone else doing this, and I don't either. It's unique in that he only charges per customer, and so it's Contax's responsibility to reduce the number of calls received. How do they do that? Well, first, by handling all complaints or problems one time and one time only. It pays dividends for them to be very efficient with how they deal with service issues, being careful not to pass calls around to people who can't solve the problem, or not trying to get people off the phone just to improve talk time or handling rates, because they don't want a caller to call back again. So the Contax model aligns the outsourcer's own economic interests with the best interests of the client, if the client's intelligent enough to figure that out, and not dwell simply on the cost of handling calls. But second, if the client has a service problem or a product quality problem of any kind that is causing a lot of calls, then the CEO said that Contax gets on the phone to the client and screams bloody murder at him to clean their act up, which is exactly what a call center ought to do with its sponsoring organization, whether it is outsourced or not. When you're getting too many calls about some kind of service problem, it's your responsibility to contact the person responsible at your firm. So no, I don't believe an accent automatically arouses mistrust. But if it's combined with incompetence, lack of information, or simply poor management, it certainly could. But in that case, mistrust would increase, even if the rep spoke the Queen's English perfectly.
Thanks to Don Peppers for sharing his insight on customer trust. Make sure to join us next month for the next installment of our podcast series. Until then, I'm Amanda Malgiri for Search CRM.